As I looked around the bay, I could see ugly gaps in the forest, owing to the nation's expansion. Houses were being built, sewers laid, and the inevitable need for more roads and cars running from the island to the city. Towns would spring up with stores and garages. The beautiful woods and sandy beaches would soon give way to the green dreams of the real estate drummers, inviting the rich and the restless to escape the immigrant hordes. When I ambled back to the house, I entered through the veranda.
"I've heard of making a garage out of a stable," Brad was saying to Rodman, "but I'm the first man who ever made a stable out of a garage."
Lily, decked out in a yellow voile blouse and a white linen skirt, announced it was time that they left. Rodman gave her one of his radiant smiles. "At this moment," she cried, "you look just like the soldier in Lexington." Their eyes met, and they stared at each other, alone in another place. She told him that he was still the same Rodman who had courted and won her before the Great War. Brad Gillespie saw and was beside himself with anger. Lily had grown recklessly bold in Rodman's presence, as if he would stand between her and her gored bull of a husband who lit a cigarette and devoured the smoke like an opium addict. Lily and Morgan, at Morgan's suggestion, excused themselves. Rodman nudged me and suggested we wait in the drive. I followed him out the front door to the shade of an elm. "I want Lily to tell him we're in love," said Rodman. "Geez, when she looked at you, I could hear a church organ, and her voice sounded like wedding bells, I hope." He had to be fantasizing. Although Lily was having an affair with Hank, she was reluctant to marry him. But now, he'd concluded, she would do more than talk. She would act. She would return to Lexington with him, take up from where they'd left off, and finish the story as he'd intended, with marriage. When Brad and the women joined us, Brad asked Hank if he'd be willing to swap cars for the ride into the city.
"I've never driven a Rolls-Royce before," said Brad.
Hank, looking none too happy, replied skeptically, "I don't know."
"Come on, sport," said Brad. "It'll be a new experience. You'll like the blue coupe. It's a Will St. Clair, almost brand new."
Lily seemed keen on the idea, so Hank reluctantly agreed, pointing out that his gas tank was almost empty. But Brad said he'd fill it just down the highway at a garage that he used. Taking Lily's arm, Brad led her toward the yellow car, but she pulled free and said that she'd travel with Hank. I stood there trying to decide what to do. The prospect of traveling with Morgan and Brad was as appealing as eating a plateful of spiders. But Brad's coupe was a two-seater. Rodman, sensitive as a spinal nerve, told me to hop into the rumble seat. "I invited you to my party. You stay with me." Morgan and Brad, obviously glad to be rid of me, climbed into Rodman's car and nearly leapt out of their skins.
"Geez," Brad cried. "Why the hell didn't you leave the car under a tree?"
Hank pretended sympathy, but as his yellow Rolls-Royce hiccuped down the gravel drive, he was truly annoyed. We followed behind. Rodman and Lily sat a respectable distance apart until we'd passed Brad filling up the yellow car at a seedy roadside garage, across the road from a billboard with some four eyes touting the T.S. Elsinore lens. Once Brad had passed out of sight, Lily slid over and embraced Rodman so warmly, I nearly suggested they just drop me off in the city and continue on by themselves to their love nest. The sunlight, heavy as honey, began to broil my brains. Rodman must have seen me wilting, because he leaned out his window to tell me to buck up. Before long, Rodman spied Brad in the rearview mirror. Lily immediately slid over to her side, maintaining a discreet distance between them. When Brad passed us, I was convinced that if we didn't stop soon, I would expire from sunstroke. In my faint state, I had the impression that every other minute Brad looked over his shoulder as if he feared that Rodman and Lily might try to ditch him and disappear. After the vaudeville, Rodman and Lily were parked at the curb sitting in the yellow car. "I thought you were driving Brad's coupe." Rodman joked without smiling, I was just letting my butler give it a spin. Lily failed to laugh, saying coldly that she was feeling emotionally frayed and that it would settle her down if she drove. Changing places with Hank, she slid behind the wheel. Although I was chattering away about Harry, the two of them were suspiciously silent. The yellow car drove past the tenements and the tubercular tradesmen, the brownstones and the bountiful, until it reached 46th Street, where Brad turned left to Broadway and the Palace Theater. Hank waited until I reached the ticket window before driving off, with Brad right on his bumper. The four of them, Hank, Lily, Brad, and Morgan, had agreed to rent a day room at the Hotel Astor and while away the early evening over drinks and noshes. As I feared, the merrymaking at the Astor had turned ugly, marked by accusations and denials. Apparently, Brad and Lily had charged one another with adultery, and then Brad had turned on Hank. As we crossed the bridge to Long Island, we passed a wedding party heading into town. Rodman stared longingly at the cars, trailing streamers and honking horns. The scene must have reminded him of what he'd lost, because he began reminiscing about Lexington. I could well understand. I felt the same way about Newark, the source of my fondest memories of Pop before he took ill. It was a time of hope. On summer days, we'd walk to the Wequick Park racetrack and sit in the stands watching the riders canter and circle the oval. Pop promised that one day he'd buy me a horse, and he did. A 3-foot-high wooden rocking horse with a miniature leather saddle. God, I must have ridden that horse 10,000 miles before I gave it away to a niece or cousin of Susie's. Yes, I knew why Hank was thinking of Lexington. It was the place of his creation, just as Newark was of mine. Decatur and Chicago were just temporary stops on his way to being born into the world he'd dreamed for himself, the one that replaced the sordid and sad with rapture and romance. Lily, having said very little, suddenly asked Hank whether it was all true. I had no idea what she was referring to, but I guessed that it had to do with the scene at the Astor. "When Brad called you a bootlegger and part of Arnold Rothstein's crowd," Hank interrupted, "I swear to you, Lily, it was all lies." "What? The plans and the promises, or the bootlegging?" "The drugstores I bought are legit. Sure, I sell alcohol, but for religious and medical purposes. Wine for Catholic masses and Jewish ceremonies. I sell propanol to hospitals. If some of the stuff falls into the wrong hands, well, I can't help that." "Walter Chase. His real name is Lester Krill. He hates me." "If he hates you, he must have a reason. I got him a job. Every man hates his banker. When he was prospering, he didn't complain. Well, apparently, he's complaining now. He broke the law. Working for you, not me, A.R. Tell me, are you or are you not one of his gang? He lent me some money." "The truth is, Hank, I have no idea what you actually do. I keep track of the profits and losses of my drugstores, which are in 20 different states. You might call me an accountant." "Who audits your books?" "Uncle Sam. I also pay taxes." Hearing that Rodman was a taxpaying citizen when so much of America was not gave her pause. "What betting laws did Brad mean?" "Sporting matches. Do you fix them?" "I never bet." "You didn't answer my question." "No." We passed over the bridge into Long Island. The road cut through a vast dumping ground. I held my breath. People are sure willing to generate garbage so long as someone else removes it. "When Brad said the drugstore business was only small change and there was something else in the wind, something bigger, you looked as if you'd killed a man." Rodman stridently laughed. For some reason, I thought a fingernail scraped across a blackboard. "Did you ever kill anyone?" Rodman looked hurt, but to his credit, he didn't duck the question. "Yes, it was in the Argonne. A German soldier charged me with a bayonet and I shot him." "I can't imagine." Seeking safe ground, Rodman found it in relating what happened. I felt so guilty. I went through his pockets to learn his name. In his wallet was an address and a photograph of his wife. After the armistice, I wrote to her explaining what had happened and enclosed $20. In the event she needed help, I told her where in France I could be reached.
Did she write to you?
Rodman nodded. We struck up a correspondence. I sent her a train ticket. She met me in Paris. Her English was poor and my German worse. But I enjoyed being with her. She reminded me of you, especially her hair. I remember taking her to a bookstall on a blustery day. Strands of her hair blew in my face. I closed my eyes and imagined that Lottie was you.
Did you make love to her?
Does it matter?
To me.
Funny about people. Although Lily was married and had a son, it was clear that she expected Hank to save himself just for her.
Brad must have meant something, she said. He has friends on the police force.
The scene in the Astor really must have been ghastly, because he returned to telling war stories, meandering into a memory of the loss of a comrade. Although I knew he was playing for sympathy, I could also see that he was deeply affected. A mystery surrounds his last moments. On a reconnaissance mission, he disappeared in the deeps of the sky. I flew with him once. The clouds are like oceans. He lost his way in their impenetrable mists. His plane was never found. He died brilliant with youth. Visibly moved, he added, "To lose you as well would be my undoing." Lily touched his arm as the car sped into the night. We were all deep in thought when Hank began to recount another war story, but Lily cut him off.
You can't turn back the clock, she said.
Of course you can if you choose.
Then find another line of work. No more drugstores, no more bootlegging, no more unsavory people.
I was beginning to feel uncomfortable. Lily was one smart cookie. I always knew it. So did Hank, who at this moment complimented her intelligence by refusing to deny her insinuations.
I admit I know about these things, but so do a lot of others, including Brad. I said as much about Brad at the Astor, but you saw how he took it. He threatened to expose you, or worse.
This reminder so upset Lily that she floored the car as if she wished to distance herself from her lover.
Bootlegging's one thing, she said. Why, some of the best people in America are wets. But the rest? If we love each other.
Lily's silence was like 1,000 years.